I'm delighted to present Steve Barber, who in 1995 formed Laris Associates, which designs, integrates, and develops comprehensive systems for electronic acoustic enhancement. Since that time, Laris Associates has installed hundreds of acoustic enhancement systems worldwide in concert halls, opera houses, performing arts centers, houses of worship, sports arenas, recording facilities, sound stages, rehearsal rooms, and outdoor venues. These included the Netherlands Opera, Berlin Staatsoper, Royal Danish Opera, the Bolshoi Theater, Sunset Center, home of the Carmel Bach Festival, Milwaukee Symphony, Indianapolis Symphony, Millennium Park in Chicago, LDS Conference Center, home to Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and many others. The Laris system has also been used in many prominent events and festivals, such as the first staging of Puccini's Turandot in the Forbidden City in 1998, and Vienna Fest during the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. So let's begin. Thank you, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for attending. I have to apologize because the session that you're here to participate in is labeled networked audio. And we don't do many networked audio systems. So it's, for me, sort of like going to visit a friend in the hospital and walking up to the nurse's desk and then having them put the cap and gown on me, point me to the patient, and say, your neurosurgery begins in a few seconds. So hopefully we'll all get through it. Until very recently, electronic architecture systems, even smaller ones, and sound reinforcement systems are usually segregated. And this is primarily because they do two different things. An acoustic enhancement system is there for one type of event that is typically acoustic in nature. It's not, you're not trying to deal with amplified sources. So the sound system is off unless you're going to do announcements, whereas the sound system, the sound reinforcement system, is there for the opposite, which is amplified music or amplified sources or speech, and the enhancement system is typically off. Where they merge is with shared components. As an example, if you're going to do film surround in a room like this and you've got a lateral array and you've got a ceiling array, well, why not? We can easily do that. Supplemental sound reinforcement, an under balcony, balcony space, and or sound effects that might be mapped throughout the room, that's 2D, 3D sound. And that's an up-and-coming thing. But each of these systems operates independently. There's no real need to send audio over a quote-unquote network, Cat5 cable, switch, etc. Control for these systems might go over that network, and that's typical Crestron AMX direct device addressing, that kind of thing. But the need for an audio network typically involves a large facility where the venue's physical size demands that you have disparate things in different places, like a central machine room that may be in another county in a control area that's pretty far away, and or where you have multiple iterations of this, multiple control points, machine rooms, etc. So I'll talk about a couple of venues where we have installed systems with networked audio. This is Millennium Park in Chicago. This venue has about a 4,000 seat fixed seating capacity, and it accommodates approximately 9,000 on top of that on the lawn packed in. There are, you can see the stage area. This is, you can't really make it out too well, but that's the sound bunker. That's where the house, front of house mix is. There is a backstage central rack room, and loudspeakers are distributed on this trellis, and to get audio to those points, which is football field and a half away, there's an underground arcade with an amp room that's about right here on this side and right here on this side. Yeah, that's about right. This is a picture, actual photo of the park, and you can barely make out the arcade on exit over here on this side. This is the what we call the headdress. Backstage area is stage left. And that's the distributed audio system for the park. So you can see we've got a lot of devices. this is the Cobranet signal flow. So we'd have typical console out, 16 outputs, plus enhancement 16 outputs, plus a separate analog drive section that all hits switches. From this switch, you hit the central rack room, plus fiber then feeds these switches in each arcade. So there's the primary rack room, and these are the Cobranet rave units. There's the arcade amp room. And we have this, the mix position. Now, typically, the Funhouse mixer is ahead of this position, but there's an A1 who sits at this desk for every performance and monitors what's going on the network. And that's John Lasecki, looking typical. with this system, we have not encountered any major failures. That is, we've never had a situation where the network has gone down, a portion of the network has gone down, where we have to panic and reset things. We've experienced a whole lot of minor incidents, and I don't want to call it death by a thousand cuts, but it's certainly a box of Band-Aids. The most typical thing that happens has nothing to do with the network, we think. That is, you lose sync. You lose sync from the control computer to everything you're trying to control. It sits there, takes its time, and comes back a bit later, but you're not able to monitor anything or change anything during that time. The biggest problem is the loss of an amp module. That is, all the DSP is in the amplifiers. So if you lose an amp, power to an amp, or you lose the module, you can't control it. And the only thing that you can do at that point is get out there and reset the module, turn the amp off, reset the module, turn the amp back on, get it back online. So if the amp goes down, you're sunk with it. You've got to get another amplifier out with a module and set it up for communication on the network. You don't have time for this. This is live audio. So spares are really important. And I don't think anyone's really talked about having the spares capacity necessary for a real networked audio system. You got to be able to change that amp out or shut it down, move the failed piece to the bench, put another amp in quickly, get it up and operational, period. That's true of anything that happens on the switch, even happens on the network, even if it's redundant. That is, if your switch goes down and you got a redundant switch, well, you're now no longer redundant. You better have another one on the shelf to replace the redundant switch. So every piece of your network has to be immediately replaceable in live applications. It's just like having an analog system there. You got to be able to replace the wire if you got somebody that runs over it with a tractor. The interesting thing about the park is that there aren't, unlike many venues that were talked about yesterday, the sports arenas, large performing arts facilities or a place like this where you've got a recording studio downstairs, a theater here, an experimental audio room downstairs where you may want to ship audio between all of these things, and you've got the university network to contend with, we don't have many conflicts at Millennium Park, and that's primarily because the pavilion is fundamentally isolated. There are no ticket sales. There are no concessions in the pavilion. There's no building management in the pavilion. It's there just to house the artists and the technical management of the facility. Security is in a separate building all on its own. There's no IT on site, so the network is fairly protected. And as a result, the audio is easier to manage because it's harder for anyone to plug into. Okay, now we'll switch gears. We'll go to the polar opposite. This is the LDS Conference Center. This is this building is in Salt Lake City. It seats 21,000. And it was built to accommodate the general conference of the LDS Church. This happens twice a year, but the primary conference happens in October usually. It's best described as an IRS audit punctuated by performances of choral music. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir rehearses and performs in the space. The choir is broadcast weekly. The programming, aside from the conference includes pageants and concerts. James Taylor was just there. This is a pageant. This is what Christmas looks like. So you're dealing with separate live audio recording and broadcast control stems and areas that share audio signals, and each of these have multiple independent control rooms, machine rooms. The networked audio is the only practical way to get this done. Now, this gives you an idea of scale now the other way. That's house mix. That's 140 feet to that point. Okay, it's another 110 feet back to the control room. That's audio control. Broadcast control is right here. And as this wraps around, it's all simultaneous language translation booths. You notice up here a catwalk. I guess you can barely see it, but this is a catwalk here. And notice that there are three levels of catwalk. Okay? That's the front of the space, and you were looking at that catwalk. So there's three levels of catwalk plus 30 feet of clear story above the catwalk. And there's a metal grid, steel grid, at the top of the top catwalk, and the machine rooms are on either side, house left, house right. The machine rooms in this facility are, if you've ever seen a walk-in locker, walk-in freezer for a restaurant, they're constructed of aluminum with a 6-inch insulation core. Those rooms are 25 feet by 80 feet, one on each side. Both rooms have a 1,500 amp, you heard that right, 1,500 amp water-cooled GE load center. Okay, so for the electronic architecture system alone, we have 20 independent acoustic machines. Now, what we call a machine is, will take two inputs and deliver four outputs, and it'll give you any kind of signal you want. You can get direct, reflected, reverberant energy any way you want it. So these machines are distributed throughout the building to deliver what they need, where they need it, why they need it. There are 680 two- and four-channel power amplifiers in the system. There are 40-plus biamp audio processors feeding the amplifiers and loudspeakers. The main floor and the rostrum are independent of this. This is just for the balcony and the mezzanine. Main floor and rostrum take dedicated AES signals. And this is the way the east side machine room Cobranet signal flow looks. Each one of the layers mainframes here has two separate machines feeding AES to an Audia XPD, which converts it to Cobranet. This feeds a switch. These feed the processors. I always like showing these. You never get to see the kind of scale. You typically see a fan-shaped room and go, oh, it's just a small room. This is 21,000 seats. That's the speaker layout, reflected ceiling plan for the primary main floor in the balcony, excluding the organ speakers and the virtual shell for the orchestra. And that's the under balcony. Takes 2 weeks to tune this. So, in general, that system, by the way, I don't know why we might flip to this already, but hang on a second. We'll work through it. In general, this facility has very few problems as well, but for different reasons. Let's see if I can get to the right slide here. Okay. Maybe I erased it. That's okay. And go back here. Sorry, I got to work through it now because I can't get to the button because of the screen resolution. What I was about to say is that this facility has very few problems as well, but for different reasons. The first is that there is a dedicated audio technician, someone who knows how to mix, someone who knows what audio is, knows the topology of that system, who is their IT guy, okay? So for each department in the facility, video, security, lighting, there's a dedicated person who is trained in that field, who is the IT guy for that department that reports to a central IT department that's run by security. Okay, so if you need something, you've got somebody working for you instead of working, trying to work with an IT department that could give a crap. Okay, and it gets done because you've got to put on the performance. And you see the scale of these performances. If you've got a problem, it's got to get resolved. Security is a big thing in this place. The security folks at the LDS Conference Center and LDS in general are highly recruited by the CIA. So when you play with their network, you do see the men in black coming for you. So you don't. So the networks are pretty secure. And we haven't had any real problems with this system for that reason, because there's a dedicated person whose job it is every day to make sure your network's working for you as an audio person. Okay, so that said, what we've seen is that currently, in today's audio topology, only larger systems get networked audio. And you can look at casinos, and you can look at all the sports arenas they talked about yesterday. Those are the kinds of facilities that lend themselves to network audio. It's difficult to justify, in today's market, however, a purpose-built facility. You're not going to build, it's going to be difficult for you to build a concert hall for a symphony orchestra only that's going to have a rehearsal space for that orchestra and just a lobby, and that's it. So what we're seeing is the concept of multi-purpose is now factored into anything that's even supposedly purpose-built. And there's an increasing demand in such a facility for multi-channel audio. Even in a lecture hall like this, the concept that you would put a Dolby Atmos system in here that's going to have about 16 to 24 channels of audio, that's the norm. Even if it only did lecture in that. But if you're going to replace... If it's really going to be a true multi-purpose facility, is that me? I better not do that. Then you've got to consider that it's going to have an electronic architecture system in it as well. And that's to accommodate the multiple sources that are going to give you the revenue to support the facility. So the one thing about multi-channel audio systems is they have a completely different lifespan than something like this. You know, somebody gets tired of this 5 years from now, you're going to come in and potentially replace it just because you're tired of it, just because it's, you know, exceeded its, I'm trying to remember the term for it, but, you know, when you depreciated value, you know, for tax purposes, you can put in another one. But when you've got your speakers permanently mounted in the ceiling and the side walls, they're not going anywhere. So replacing all of this infrastructure and components is both impractical and it's going to be costly. And for this reason, we only use transport protocols for digital audio that are standard. In this case, it's AES. And that, today, is MADI. Now, tomorrow, that could be that. AES 67 has great promise for smaller facilities, and I think it'll really be the means by which a smaller facility integrates multi-channel audio cost-effectively in the future. Okay, so there's that one. Any questions? Comments, otherwise? Okay, let's move on to what I really came here to do. First, this paper was supposed to be given by Anthony Natoli. And for anyone who's done live audio, you'll appreciate this. The project ran late. So Anthony is right now in Columbia tuning a new concert hall instead of being here. The Park Avenue Armory was built in 1871, it's completed in 1880. It's home to the 7th Regiment Militia, which is known as Silk Stocking Regiment, mainly because most of the people In the regiment were the sons of New York elite and the wealthiest families. This is a Thomas Nast painting. The 7th Regiment departs for war. It's a pretty famous painting, and it hangs in the armory. It was built by the Who's Who of New York City. It's decorated by the then leading designers or up-and-coming designers of the time, including Tiffany. And that's the Park Avenue Armory. This building occupies a city block in New York, an entire city block, on Park Avenue. This is the most expensive real estate in the country. And the reason that it exists at all is because it houses the largest single collection of Tiffany interiors in the world. Okay, but that's not our focus. Our focus is the 55,000 square foot balloon shed ceiling, 4.5 second reverb time, Wade Thompson drill. Okay. I'll give you some scale of perspective. One of the first performances that was, in fact, it was the inaugural performance in this hall, had an orchestra of 500 and a chorus of 1,200. Okay, but this is now a performing arts center. Art center and performing arts center. They do some of the strangest, I don't know what I've done to this thing, I'll try not to do it again. Most unique performances you can imagine, but they have the wherewithal to do it and the money to do it. This opera, this opera. Note the seating is back here, but it started up here. Note the railroad tracks, okay? So this opera was staged so the entire seating moved on the railroad tracks, exposing scene by scene that stayed in place until the end of the opera. Again, art exhibits. I have a photo of one where the entire place is full of swings and cloth, and as you pull on one swing, someone goes up at the other end of the building. There it is. Dance. And Lincoln Center is tied in with the armory to produce music. Now, there are two important factors that influence the design of any system: sound reinforcement or acoustic enhancement. They are the physics of the venue, the size and its geometry, and the programming, what you're going to do, where, when, and why, and how. In most large venues, you sort of know what you're doing. As an example, you saw Millennium Park, you saw the LDS Conference Center. We also do a number of arenas in the country. But we know what to expect as a sound source in each of these venues. We're going to come out here, we're going to listen to some kind of thing, music likely. We're going to experience sports over here. Maybe you're a Disney Ice show, and okay, I'm going to sing a hymn over here, maybe. But in this place, we don't know about anything about the sound sources. Here, you know, most places, you know what you're going to get for a sound source. You know where it is. You know something about the expectations. And you can design, then, infrastructure necessary to support that. This is the armory. That's a Boeing 767, just for scale. And we were charged to do something rather unique. We're going to put on a performance of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra doing St. Matthew's Passion in a similar manner that they do it in their concert hall, with the same listening experience that you have in Berlin. So we're going to take a 4.5 second hall, we're going to make it a 2.5 second hall, and we're going to make it sound like Berlin. That was the goal. That's Berlin. Okay, not your typical concert hall. It's called a vineyard hall. Okay, so seating is in the round. And St. Matthew's Passion is performed in the round. Okay, so in order to make this work, the expense for this was astronomical. By the way, this performance was going to be one night. Okay? The next night, they were going to perform a different concert in Carnegie. Okay. So in order to make a system like this from a rental or purchase perspective even remotely viable, It had to be used for other things. That means that we had to look at both what would happen before and after St. Matthew's Passion as a as an objective. And we had no, you saw what was going on in this place. We had no clue. And in most other venues, this would involve, okay, I know what the straightforward, what this infrastructure is going to be. It's going to be a bunch of amps. It'll be in an amp room. We'll send cables out. Well, there is no infrastructure in this place. This is what you would typically do. But the Park Avenue Armory has no infrastructure. It's all movable. It's all configured for a given performance. You want to hang it, you want to put a cable in, you've got a lift, you got a piece of truss, you got a chain motor, and that's how you're getting your cable up. So this is much more complex for anything you do than any touring event. It involves multiple trades and crews that have never worked together before. And the equipment may need to move to different locations in the venue depending on what they want to do. Now, on top of this, the armory decided that, okay, we're in New York, we can rent stuff. There's stuff to rent. So things that are typical that they could get their hands on, like amplifiers and cable, they'll rent. So part of the system, we don't know what it is on any given day. There's not a piece of cable in the building. So it's far from typical. Our design considerations, well, we needed to be able to do anything from anywhere with multiple zones of sound reinforcement, 2D, 3D sound, live tracking, acoustic amps, enhancement processing. So the only way around this is to design something big enough from a fundamental architectural standpoint that you could pull it down as necessary to do smaller events. And we settled on was a 500-channel point-to-point-to-point matrix with 320 hardware inputs and outputs. That would accommodate 64 channels for sound reinforcement, 16 to 64 channels for analog inputs, 16 microphones for acoustic enhancement, 64 channels of independent for the independent acoustic engines returning and going out to the venue. And this is the basic signal flow of the system that we're talking about. We're going to take microphone signals in, we're going to ship them over MADI to what we call a matrix processor that does this matrix mixing. They'll get processed, sent over to an acoustics engine that has one of these frames. The mainframe 3 has four separate acoustics machines in it. That audio gets sent back over to the matrix processor, then to conversion. This is what we call an AT32, which provides ELCOs for the power amplifiers. When we put them in the rack, of course, we had to do something completely different, amplifiers and loudspeakers. So that's the way the basic signal flow in the system works. And as you need more acoustics processing, you add it simply by adding more mainframes. The fundamental architecture, though, supported all those channels. So if you needed more input channels to the system, you just added more conversion. You could remote your conversion anywhere in the building using fiber. So that made everything portable and tractable for what they might do in the future. That's what it looks like in practice. This is the first show. Even the power comes in portably. So everything from about here over is rented, including all the cable. All right, so one of the issues that we had with this is now you have to consider what your loudspeaker complement is going to be in a 4.5 second room. You have to have enough loudspeakers to meet the design objectives for the Berlin Philharmonic, but you also have to have enough to meet either side of it. A typical two-way high-frequency pattern control-like box like this doesn't have low-frequency pattern control at all, and that's where you need it in a space like this. You've got to have broadband power uniformity if you're going to do acoustic enhancement. The speaker like this is immediately noticeable as a separate sound source, mainly because the high frequencies and low frequencies have completely different pattern control. You have to have a sufficient number, and you have to have broadband power pattern control down low, which means that the size of the loudspeaker is going to be big. That's our primary reinforcement speaker for direct and reflected energy. That's it next to a typical box like the one up here. Okay? So there's 16 of these in the system. There are 56 three-way, 120-degree conic enhancement speakers. Okay, so our first show was called The Machine. Straight play, supposedly, out of Manchester West End. Far from straight. The concept was, it started as a straight play in Manchester, but no one told us that some of the principals in the show had weak voices, so they put wireless body packs on them. So now it's a mix of body pack and straight play. This is the layout of the loudspeakers, primary loudspeakers, and you can see them up here. Each one faces a separate seating area, four at a time. And the concept is that, these are the enhancement speakers. These are enhancement and supplemental sound reinforcement speakers over those seating areas. So the concept is, these are line array microphones. Someone was talking about this in the microphone session. We use them here as well. So we've got line array microphones on the corners of the box, and the concept is as an actor faces, let's say, this way, the two microphones here and here pick up the actor and distribute sound to the three other seating areas so that when they turn their back to those areas, they're still understood while the primary reinforcement hits that seating area. So it's a multi-channel matrix mix that doesn't need any adjustment. It's self-adjusting as the actors walk around the stage. And that's what it looks like in production. The straight play called The Machine, by the way, was Garry Kasparov versus IBM Deep Blue chess match, hence the chess motif and the boxing match, boxing ring. All right, so the next performance that we had to tackle was called Passenger. This is a bit more complex. You see a railroad track going down, and there's the superstructure of a ship. Okay, so the theme of the play, and this is not even a play, this is an opera, is that a Nazi death camp supervisor is on a cruise later and thinks she sees someone she's killed at the camp. So action traverses between the camp, which is depicted by these railroad cars, and the cruise ship. Notice over here there's a full symphony orchestra. So this from a general setup, this is a bit more complex. You've got dedicated acoustic enhancement for these guys, dedicated acoustic enhancement here. Signals from here are sent there and vice versa. Separate dedicated acoustic enhancement here plus direct sound coming this way. More of the same. These are the direct sound speakers going up, and there are three rows of them for distributed audio. And that's what it looks like in production. We used the line array microphones in the front and back here because the chorus would load into these railroad cars and there'd be an offstage chorus singing into line array mics. This is what we came to do. It's the Berlin Philharmonic layout. And you can see the loudspeakers, all 16 of them, primary loudspeakers are over the in the round stage. The seating area includes orchestra here and here, chorus here, and I believe here. There's also an upstage chorus way up here. The choruses all get down and march around the stage and then walk back to their positions. So you've got dedicated acoustic enhancement for the orchestra and each chorus section, dedicated acoustic enhancement for the entire audience areas that's separate, plus direct reinforcement. And you'll see it a bit better here. That's the upstage chorus is over here. And the line array microphones are positioned, let's see, I know they're up here, but they're about here, 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 and here, facing the center of the stage. That's what it looked like in pre-production. And that's what it looked like in performance. One night. All right, so we get through this, and then the next thing comes up. This is Tears Become, Streams Become, which is Helene Grimaud. It's a massive engineering undertaking. The artist's vision is that we're going to take the entire floor, 55,000 square foot floor of the armory, and we're going to build a pool of water so that it reflects the ceiling above. Okay? Air engineering were hired to do this, and this is pretty involved. Steinway was going to provide the pianos. They wanted a specific humidity for the pianos, so the water had to be pre-chilled, filtered. They had to figure out the structural engineering for the weight loads of the water, waterproof the floor construction in a way that the water wouldn't affect the materials and the materials wouldn't affect the water, creating a completely level surface on that floor that's over 100 years old that was a cavalry muster building. Silent water, absolutely silent water pumps and plumbing for it all. Temporary water storage and filtration. Humidity levels, that, again, that wouldn't affect the pianos. And this is the temporary floor going down in place. We're going to turn the audio on now. There we go. So this is the time lapse of the floor going down. Okay, so what you did notice or sort of at the end is it looks like a flat floor, except that during performance, water's already sitting just below the floor. And it takes 20 minutes for the water to rise without making any noise whatsoever and settle and become a mirror. She's playing during this time. So the lights are off, focus spotlights are on her. She's playing along for 20 minutes. She stops and then they turn on the lights, and this is what you see, which is a complete mirror of the ceiling above. It was really stunning. So, again, more conclusions. In this building, we've demonstrated to the Army as well as Lincoln Center that the approaches that we've taken can produce successful results, and by successful for Lincoln Center, that means sound that doesn't sound amplified yet is. And that means blending traditional body mic techniques with ambient sound in such a way that it's undetectable. You can't ignore the natural acoustics of the space, and unfortunately Anthony wasn't here to talk about that, but in order to stop this room, you've got massive floor-to-ceiling drapes that have to go in for every production in a different way. Each performance is unique. It requires careful attention to everything. The nature of the building makes everything labor intensive, and that's true of any large space, though. And when enhancement is required, the smaller things that might be able to be done in a place like this can't be just because of cost. So, in essence, this place really lends itself for some dramatically unique and different programming, but it takes real effort. And that's it. Thanks.
So, are there any questions for Steve? That's impressive. It's amazing. It's a huge undertaking. It's amazing.
Every time.
Yeah.
You start from scratch every time.
How is the background noise from the city?
Surprisingly, it's, again, you take the effort to drape off certain areas of the building that would normally produce noise. The skylights you can't do much about. You're going to get noise through them. But most of the performances are in the evening after traffic has died down substantially. Mm-hmm. So it's surprisingly okay. Unlike Millennium Park, where the concerts would start at 6:30 in the evening, 7 o'clock in the evening, in the middle of rush hour traffic. So Michigan Avenue is full of traffic.
Right. There's no ambulance hospital nearby or...
We really haven't been clobbered that way.
No.
Whereas again, in Millennium Park, you can count on it.
Right.
What did you get the reverberation time
down? We can drop it down to about 2.5 seconds mid-band. That's not the issue. It's not reverberation time. It's reverberation level. And by putting up enough drape, you're just stopping mid-band sound from hitting a surface in the first place, which is dropping the level down sufficiently so that you could put the early energy components in that create the room that you're trying to emulate. That's the key here. It's not that you're creating reverberation with the enhancement system. You're creating the missing piece, the room. And if, again, you have to treat this room with kid gloves. If you put some low-frequency stuff out there, it's going to come back. It's going to hurt you.
So you're not putting much of the diffuse late reverberation?
You're trying to blend in against it. There's this distant tail that's way out there.
Right.
And the object is to put, again, the spatial impression of the room,
yeah,
its reverberation, and then blend that naturally into the decay of
to
the space.
Off. Yeah.
So that doesn't interfere any longer. Mm-hmm. It's no longer a separate thing that you focus on as a separate sound event.
Right.
It's integrated into that first 2 seconds of decay.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions?
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.